Welcome to Just the Taste. I'm Scott Curry with Chef's Best. We gather to talk about the trends in marketing, retail, and production in food and beverage that are shaping the industry. Today, we are joined by our very special guest, Susie Badaracco. Susie Badaracco is a toxicologist, certified chef, and registered dietitian. She holds a bachelor's of science degree in criminalistics, an associate's degree in culinary arts, and a master's of science degree in human nutrition. Susie has worked as an analytical chemist, corporate chef, nutrition specialist, trainer, and knowledge manager for organizations including Mintel, USDA, Nestle, T. Marzetti, and Ajinomoto, Inc. since 1992. Susie has been trained in military intelligence and predictive analysis techniques used by both corporate and government bodies. Using these techniques, she has been able to successfully predict and profile food trends in the United States, from health and ingredients trends to restaurants, consumers, fast food and fast casual restaurants, grocery stores, and manufacturing trends. She is president of Culinary Tides, where she provides forecasting services to determine influences on food, flavor, and health trends. I think we're in for a really special and interesting podcast with Susie. Susie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you.
Great. Well, you certainly obviously have an interesting background and apply that to the food and beverage industry. So we want to talk a little bit about that background and how you utilize that unique skill set and education to forecast trends. And then maybe we'll play a little bit of fun and game later and see if we can identify what the trends are moving forward.
Great.
So when determining current trends and future trends, which are two different things, but when determining current and future trends, what inputs do you look at to determine what those trends are?
Well, since it's chaos work and based on military intelligence techniques, we can only use quantitative data. So we can't use opinions or anything qualifying. We have to use quantitative. So for instance, my day starts out by reading 65 newspapers a day. I also read 38 print magazines a month. We track 15 governments daily at a minimum. So we're dealing with mass amounts of quantitative data to be able to simultaneously predict on current trends and where they're going to go, and then also be able to see trends that have not been born yet.
Wow. Okay. So you just blew me away there. 65 newspapers a day. Yeah. Obviously not front to back, front to back. Wow. So what are you looking for within those, you know, I mean, you have vast sections of newspapers and articles. What is it that you're looking for? Of course,
so
quantitatively.
What we're tracking is, so we only work for the food industry, anybody in the food industry on the playground. So what we're looking for is anything, related to government trends. We track government trends, adversaries and allies, all technologies worldwide, food and flavor trends for this country, but also looking at them worldwide. We track all research, so including any consumer behavioral research, survey research, industry research, and then trends research. Also look at clinical health studies around the world. So those are the main areas that we're watching for, and those areas help us then see what's going to hit our clients.
Okay, so you have all these, you know, studies, research being done, probably movements within the industry.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Everything from mergers and acquisitions can factor into things.
Yeah, exactly. So just with competitors, if we're watching competitors, we're watching at all times, we're watching acquisitions, sales, we're watching alliances that a company may form, new products, any packaging changes, strategy moves, promotions they're doing. So just that one piece is very complicated. And then we're pairing it with all the other movements on the ground that could hit our clients.
Okay. So I'm instantly fascinated here, Susie, so bear with me. So without giving away too much of your proprietary models, what are you doing with this data? Are you, is there a spreadsheet that you're putting it in that you've created an algorithm around to predict things? What do you do with the data?
So with every client, what we're doing is we're looking for patterns in chaos for each client. So a normal monthly report, let's say for any one of our clients, would have an average of 185 research reports in just 1 month. So 185, it could be a research report, it could be a movement like you mentioned, like it could be someone bought somebody or government passed legislation, but basically 185 different quantitative hits goes into just a single monthly report. So a beverage company's report every month would look wildly different than, you know, a snack company's report, for instance. And so What we're doing is we're simultaneously looking for patterns on current trends they're already involved in and where those are going, but then also at the same time monitoring future trends that could be born. And we use military analytics to be able to visualize those. So we're the only ones in the country that do this.
Okay. Got it. So if I'm a company and, you know, I obviously assume that I'm going to, because you're an expert, which means I don't know how and where to look. What questions are they typically looking to have answered, and what steps do you take to help them impact their business? So does a company come to you and say, hey, I just want to know where milk production is going to be in 3 years, because I need to know my margins in 3 years? Or so what is the process you go through to help identify what the questions are? Because a lot of times companies and people, and like, they're not always looking at the right question. So how do you help with that?
Yeah, exactly. So they'll come to us, and we'll have them give us, we have a hit list. So we have them give us a hit list of things they think they're interested in. So, and it's much broader because we're dealing with them every single month, year in and year out. And we're always, every quarter, we push them out another 18 months to 2 years. So every quarter, we're quietly reforecasting their entire playground. And it just kind of shifts slightly every single quarter. So they're out at all times about 18 months to 2 years out. So they'll tell us what they think they want to watch. Broadly, like they'll say, you know, organic, and we want to see the refrigerated. We're interested in breakfast trends, maybe whole grain trends, because we're a snack company. And then we come in and fill in all the gaps. So that'll trigger us to realize what they're not looking for that we think they should be looking for. So the questions are usually pretty broad to set up a client. It's usually, you know, how is X trends, the whole list, going to affect the product lines, let's say, that they're telling us. So let's say it's a snack company. We're going to have to hone everything just around whatever their snack company is. So let's say plant proteins, whole grains, they might be organic, sustainability issues, packaging technologies they definitely want, salt sugar technologies they would want. So we will build around what their product lines are to be able to capture their entire playground at any one time. So every client will be a little bit different on exactly what we want to be focused on looking for, to be able to make sure we're not just giving them a lot of research that, you know, really doesn't apply to them.
Okay, got it. So how, you know, perhaps with some examples, you certainly don't have to disclose who your clients are, but what are some of the effects that you have seen on someone's business? Maybe someone knows to increase their manufacturing, or I'm just throwing out things here, or they know that they should be prepared to hire more people, or that maybe, you know, it might go the other way, that they need to diversify their product line because a trend is winding down. What are some of the kind of the hard impacts to business, the bottom line, if you will?
Yeah, it could be all of that. So since we deal with the strategy branches or the marketing branches, depending on how the company is set up, they're looking for long-range strategy moves. So for instance, I'll give you an example. We had a fast food client. This is a few years back. We have a fast food client who, when street food first started coming up back in 2008, you know, we explained to him the street food trend, what it is, how long it's going to last, what the impacts are. And so we don't ever tell a company what to do specifically or what not to do, because we are not that corporate personality. So what that company did, we had two different companies. One company took the street food trend and put street food items like little tacos on their menu, right? Another company with the same intelligence and information, they decided instead to launch a truck, so a street food truck based on their restaurant. So So two totally different approaches to the same trend, both successful, and both fit those two companies' personalities. So our job is to really be the insurance policy and keep them safe. And so, yeah, we definitely let companies know when to exit a trend. You know, if a trend is, we know, is on the decline and why it's on the decline, so they can strategize how to get out or how to downsize on the trend. If they want to enter a trend, we make sure their pathway is as clear as possible, because not all trends are super friendly. Some trends have pitfalls, and so we have to make sure that they enter it as safe as possible.
Hmm. So you allow them to either enter as a leader, because, you know, being 2 years late in this industry, you know, you can, you know, your market share isn't going to be there. Your brand has already been, you know, someone's already ahead of you, or you help them identify that a trend is winding down and it's time to change, you know, whether it's change their menu or start, you know, R&D on a new product. You help them look around that corner.
Yeah, exactly. And they'll also, like, they might want to enter a trend and have, let's say, five different products that they want to enter. And we'll be able to tell them which of the five would have the longest life. So it can help narrow, you know, exactly how they enter a trend. And then also some clients don't want to be the leader. Some just want to be, you know, the fast followers, and are a little more conservative on what they launch, whereas other clients are kind of the fringe cutting edge, and they're going to launch the more exotic type of offering for the exact same trend.
Sure. Okay. So I have to ask, how did you know the street food trend was coming?
that was, since we deal with such mass amounts of quantitative data at all times, we can see these things, you know, a few years in advance. So street food has a complicated birth. It was called a fusion birth. And a fusion birth means it had multiple parents. So one of the parents of street food was the war that we had entered. Another one was the economic downturn. So street food, in a nutshell, lets you explore exotic offerings from other countries without having to pay. They're less expensive, usually a street truck, than going to, you know, a restaurant. And then on top of it, there's a lot of fear at the time. And so by literally seeing and meeting who is cooking the food and they're handing it to you themselves, was another advantage of street trucks that kind of helped, and a number of other things. But all of those things together helped the rise of street food and let it go national.
Wow, that's interesting. So people were perhaps a little suspicious in their social interactions and felt more comfortable, you know, typically with a street, you know, food truck, you place the order with the individual and you watch that individual cook it, and then that individual hands it to you. So you see the entire kind of life cycle, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. So when we go into a recession, what builds is a lot of fear on all ends for consumers, and a lot of trust issues. And so that's one of many things that help manifest street trucks in particular to be able to go national.
Wow. Okay. So I'm going to force myself to move on, because I could probably do a 1 hour episode just on,
sure.
on street food there. Because it's interesting, and you know, I'm in San Diego, where I believe it was one of the early adopters of street foods, and I had heard even that one of the reasons why food trucks came along was in certain cities, the chefs were not able to get licenses for liquor and just be able to open up restaurants, and I'm sure, you know, there are cost barriers to entry there as well. So that they said, well, here's kind of a workaround for that. If I can't open my own restaurant for all these various reasons, what I can do is take my restaurant mobile.
And that really occurred after the trend was already born.
Oh, okay.
So the trend was already born, and then that ramped it up even more.
Got it. So you're a couple of years ahead of me at all times, Susie.
Let's hope.
What other, so you're on the street food trend. It sounds like well in advance. You're mentioning that during the war you started coming. So I don't know. That feels like you're well ahead of that one. What other trends were you, you know, could you perhaps take a little bit of humble credit for being an early identifier of?
The other one would be Soul Food or Deep Southern. We also saw that back around 2008, too. And that had a different path and a different birth than street food. But the Deep South and the Soul Food and all that actually was born out of the first adopters of that was actually fast food and fast casual are the ones that really kind of made that one go national. But again, part of it was born in, you know, fast food in the diner scenario down in the Deep South. It's always been there, right? But what caused it to go national, again, was when we had the fear going on with the war, we went to more regional, closer in cuisines. Deep South happened to be the one that kind of took the spotlight. But a number of fast food and fast casual restaurants started launching Deep South, and a lot of barbecue chains also took their brand a lot more national in a very, very short period of time. Cookbooks started coming out around soul food and street and Deep South. 2009 was the first time Bon Appetit actually named New Southern as the IT cuisine for the year. Then in 2013, Bon Appetit named it again, because it was still going, so it named it again as the IT cuisine for 2013. So twice it got named. And what it's done since then, and what our clients are in on now, is Deep South has to reinvent itself at some point. So what it's done is it's morphed and it's caused little cousins to be born. And the cousins include Appalachian cuisine, Low Country cuisine, Ozark cuisine. So the Deep South flavors, you know, Cajun Creole, are getting more signature, getting more regionalized, and they're traveling up the East Coast. So that's where we're getting the Ozark and the Appalachian and the Low Country. Low Country is South Carolina and the Georgian coast. And then it kind of goes up from there. So that one we're still watching because it's now in, you know, it's like Southern food is still there. But fried chicken, for example, did not get born in high-end restaurants at all. It got born in the diners of the South and went then to fast food and then now is morphing and birthing little cousins that we're watching. So sometimes the trend looks like it came out of nowhere, but it really didn't. In fact, we've never seen a trend that, quote, come out of nowhere. We can always pinpoint its birth and then predict, you know, how long it's going to last, how short it's going to last, if it's going to change or morph, what it's going to look like.
Fascinating. So I think that a trend right now is farm to table. I don't know if it's a trend or here to stay for a long time, but it's certainly popular in Southern California here. So tell me about farm to table. Is it here to stay?
Yeah, farm to table is what we call a Pandora's box. And there's only ever a handful, like two or three Pandora's boxes at any one time. It's a Pandora's box, meaning once it's opened, you're really not going to be able to shut that down. It has no, and the other thing about a Pandora's box, it has no adversaries. So there's no other, you know, trend as an adversary that could compete with it. It's its own little entity. And what Farm to Table has done is it has morphed into, again, more cousins like, you know, fin to tail and root to stem. And, you know, so there's little evolutions of it beyond just farm to tail, you know, head to tail. Like, so if you're dealing with animal protein. So Farm to Table isn't, how do I put it? It's the poster child actually in a faction of trends that are all the same personality. So farm to table is the same thing as root to stock. It's the same thing as head to tail. It's the same thing as, you know, ocean to table. You know, it's just a poster child within those, which is also what makes it so strong. But yeah, it's one of those things where it doesn't have any adversaries. There's no downside to it. It's going to be here whether we're in recession or recovery for economy. It's just going to have more little morphs kind of coming off of it and new little, you know, cousins that get born from it. But yeah, there's really no sign of this thing going anywhere.
Cool. All right. Okay. So, you know, we all know about the organic movement, which I'm going to attempt to be an expert. I'm going to label the organic movement a Pandora's box. I think it's here to stay. I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong in a moment, but and now it's kind of becoming a non-GMO movement, right? It's almost like organic extreme, for lack of a better way to
yeah.
position. And now that's morphing into a kind of clean label. So When will we reach peak organic? Are we all going to be eating organic in 5 years? I'm sure there's production problems around that. Or are we just, is it going to be a socioeconomic question? Where's organic going to go? Because it's moving fast, obviously.
Yeah, no. Okay, so organic is a poster child, again, for the sustainability movement. Organic itself is not a trend. It's a poster child under the sustainability trend. That's really the Pandora's box of sustainability, the big branch of sustainability.
Okay.
Organic ebbs and flows. It is never going to take over the world. It can't because of production issues. It can't because of cost issues. And it's the first thing consumers in this country abandon to an extent during a recession. So while we're in recovery and good time, yes, absolutely, organic numbers go up. Sales go up. And then they drop off the face of the planet if we're in recession. So that ebbs and flows. Again, you have cost barriers. It's got a glass ceiling. It's got cost barriers. Consumers will buy some organic, but not all organic. Some buy absolutely none because they don't feel it's worth the price, or they just can't afford it anyways. So if you reach peak organic, it just means that we're at the top of a recovery. And that will go away then as soon as we go back into recession or you know, even a depression, obviously, it gets abandoned. GMO actually does fall under sustainability, not because non-GMO, but GMO itself is a sustainable way to grow plants, larger crop yields, healthier plants, so on and so forth. The non-GMO movement in this country is actually based on fear and ignorance. We know this from behavioral studies and survey work. Consumers are fearful of GMO, but they have absolutely no idea what GMO is. So there's been several studies out that show if you take, you know, people who do not like GMO, don't want to buy GMO, you educate them for about 20 minutes, 65 to 85% not only want GMO, they will pay more for it. So once they understand, because what they don't understand is they don't understand GMO technologies are also used for, you know, things like increasing vitamin A in rice to feed some of the populations in Asia and Africa, let's say. They don't understand that Florida State has a technology out there that has removed the protein from a peanut plant so people with peanut allergies can eat peanuts. That's a GMO technology. It's a deletion technology. They don't understand that a lot of the GMO technologies are for, let's say, allowing people in different countries to grow crops that may have salt in the soil or may have a shorter growing season. But now they're able to grow those crops where they couldn't before because of GMO. So that's what changes their minds really quickly. So Europe and Asia, if you watch their governments, they're all backing off now on non-GMO. They're allowing, you know, Africa now, certain countries allow it in their supermarkets. China right now is looking to grow more crops and allow more crops in that are GMO. So we're the only ones actually going backwards on this thing. And that's why we know it's fear and ignorance, because there is no research showing that GMO is harmful to humans. It hasn't been for 20 years we've been watching it. Clean label is a totally separate thing. It's not sustainability at all. It was birthed out of fear. And it's really just the matter of, you know, control, a consumer wanting to be in control of what they're eating, wanting to know what's on the label, wanting to understand what the ingredients are. So that's kind of its own trend, not really related to organic and non-GMO. It looks like it is, but it really is a separate birth pattern and reason it's going on. But the three of them kind of end up on the playground together, even though, you know, only organic and non-GMO, they're kind of cousins. Clean label is like their best friend that came from down the street to play with them.
So you've mentioned fear a couple times. Obviously a very, very powerful emotion that drives our interpersonal interactions, our, you know, larger macroeconomic decisions. So I would imagine to determine when fear is entering a marketplace, are you looking at things like consumer confidence index, but are there any other less publicized numbers that you look at relative to the food industry?
Yeah, so to look at fear specifically, one of the things we're looking at economic indicators. So in a quarter, in 3 months, we're tracking usually 15 to 20 different reports that have come out. So we're specifically looking at economic behavior, so how consumers are spending, but we're also looking at confidence behavior, so what are they saying? So sometimes they say, oh, I'm fearful, I don't have confidence. But then you see all the restaurant numbers are up, the grocery numbers are up. So they're saying they're fearful, but what they're really doing is going out and spending. Mm-hmm. So we that's why you have to look at behavioral research plus survey work together to really get a picture of what they're doing. So that's one of the many ways we're looking at to see if there is like fear on the ground. The other thing that we watch for is, and this pattern repeats over and over, if you're in an economic recovery, what you see on the menu or in the grocery store is you see global foods, exotic foods, more edgy offerings, more limited time offerings, more exotic fruits and vegetables coming in, more unusual, let's say, meats coming in, like different cuts or different, you know, seafood that you're not really familiar with. All of that comes in. And also the big thing during recovery is extremes on the palate. So you get citrus, chilies, for instance, anything extreme on the palate. That's why right now we have sour, fermented, all of these things extreme on the palate. If you're in a recession or heading that way, what you get is macaroni and cheese and meatloaf.
Wow.
And that's domestic beer. So in recovery, you get cocktails and, you know, smaller exotic varietals of wine. In recession, you get California wine and domestic beer. No cocktails, wow. No desserts.
And it's mind blowing here. if you haven't written the book yet, Susie, let's get going on that. I would suppose, and I'm not going to ask you to really provide insight into this, but I would suppose that fashion would follow the same
oh, right? That's actually hilarious. Yeah, because it's not just the food industry people react to it. We watch other neighboring industries. So we actually do watch the fashion industry. And yeah. I will tell you and I say this every year at conferences, if Pantone, you know, and the fashion industry comes out with earth colors, earth tones, panic, because we may be heading into recession. If earth tones are the color, or they pick, you know, some kind of very calm taupe, oh yeah, absolutely panic. What you want to see Pantone in the fashion industry coming out with is the craziest things ever. That's when you know we're still experimental, we're still, you know, educating ourselves, and it'll translate straight to the food too, right? So instead of blueberries, you get dragonberries and durian. Instead of coconut, you get, you know, lulo and pichu berries. So there's an extreme there, but yeah, so we absolutely watch the fashion industry. It's so funny that you hit on that.
Well, okay, so if everyone starts filling up on mac and cheese in front of me and everyone's wearing beige, then I need to batten down the hatches.
Oh yeah, if Cooking Light comes out with like the best meatloaf recipes, just panic. Just go ahead and start panicking now. You know, unless they're putting truffles on the macaroni and cheese or lobster, yeah, it's not good. So for instance, with the election that just occurred, you know, doesn't matter who you voted for, there's a whole lot of fear. So right now in the food industry, we're seeing a stall pattern, not a recession, just a stall pattern. And a lot of these comfort foods are kind of trickling back in because, again, for different reasons, there's a lot of people in the country right now who are feeling uncertain, you know, not grounded. So we're already seeing that in the last quarter, a little bit of this fear trickling into the food end of things. So right now we are kind of seeing meatball recipes, and we're, you know, it's a stall. It's not, you know, but it's just this time of uncertainty right now. So we are seeing a little bit of that right now.
Sure. So I wasn't going to go there, but you tiptoed in. So let's tiptoe in here. So changes in Washington, we're not going to get into, but are you looking more at what is being done from a policy standpoint, or are you looking at, you know, just kind of, I don't know, let's call it, I don't know if zeitgeist is the right word, but just the overall tone and themes that are being, you know, produced, not saying positive or negative, but there's definitely a change in, I think, themes going on right now. Or are you just waiting for policy and that's...
No, what we're really watching is consumers' reaction to what the new administration is doing. So the administration, any administration could do wildly different things. But if America's like, woohoo, that's exactly what we've been waiting for, yay, we're still going to be eating dragonberries and durian. That's not what's happening, though. What's happening is a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear, a lot of protesting. That's what we're really watching for, is more the reaction to the administration is what we're most interested in looking at.
Because people, you know, some people may start clutching their wallets a little bit more.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, exactly. They'll feel more uncertain about their jobs, their health care, and that fear will then spiral into causing changes literally on the plate and in the restaurant.
Wow. Okay. So.
And so I will say one thing is that we know it's a stall, not like recession. I'm not saying that at all. We know it's a stall because nothing actually has happened yet.
Right.
Like, we didn't change healthcare yet. We didn't suddenly get into a war with anybody. There has been no new housing crisis. So the fear is kind of an internal fear that people are feeling uncertain, but it's not that anything actually has happened yet. That's why we know it's a stall, not, oh my gosh, it's things on the market are seriously changing. It's more a perceived fear is what's going on.
I'm going to preface this question with a very broad assumption, but let's just go with it. I think that there is, you know, I think enough evidence that people on the coasts feel a certain way about the situation versus some of the inland and southern states. And I'm making a huge sweeping generalization here, but to the point that I'm trying to make is, how do you need to look at regional behaviors when advising your clients, understanding that the recession in 2008 hit certain areas harder than others, how people feel about, you know, the current administration is likely to be different whether you're living in Boston, Massachusetts versus, you know, Oklahoma City. When you have national, you know, clients and businesses that you advise, are you able to break things down into, you know, regional, you know, you might have natural disasters that hit and could impact an area as well. The state of Florida comes to mind with hurricanes. How do you look at regions as well and advise versus national?
So that is a big question. So yes, we definitely look at regions. We also break down consumers by age group, and we also break them down by economic income. Those three alone can change how different sections of the country might react to a trend. Trends, though, also enter the country in different parts of the country. So a lot of people think it's more simplistic, like, oh, the coasts always are the first on the trend. And that's not at all how it happens. So, for instance, Cuban food and came up through Florida, went straight up the East Coast, and now is spreading out to the West. So it was born in Florida, basically, because of its proximity. Arctic cuisine or Nordic cuisine actually has its strongest hold in the upper Midwest in the United States. So Minneapolis, you know, Minnesota, Chicago, upstate New York, Wisconsin, because that's where the pocket of people live who are Scandinavian background, right? Mm-hmm. So its strongest hold is there. The deep southern, again, came in from obviously the deep south, but went west first and then up east. And again, it's where did that population relocate itself? So regionally, it's easy to say that, oh, the center of the country is a little more conservative than the outer realms, right? But if you look at a hybrid, like there's hybrid and mashup trend going on right now, hybrid and mashup trend in beef and pork, let's say the Iron Age pig, which is actually a hybrid breed, that started smack dab in the middle of the country, right? Mm. Where the pork is grown. So you're looking at a half a dozen things around any trend to be able to say more specifically exactly what that trend is going to do or how a part of the country is going to react to it. So, it is, I don't know if I answered that correctly, but it is very complicated, like how the different regions are going to react, how a trend is going to kind of be showcased in that region. has a lot of different things that go into it, what they depend on.
Got it. And there's a lot to celebrate there too. And I think another reason to encourage when you do travel to eat local and to try and sample different foods.
Exactly.
Don't just, you know, go into the nearest fast food restaurant.
No, exactly. So we have to watch the travel industry extremely closely because what happens with travel trends will often birth a food trend, and it's usually about a year out. So the Arctic and Nordic food trend actually was born first in the travel industry, and then it couriered, we call it travel a courier, it couriered into the food industry. So, and actually the first one on the Arctic and Nordic that went national was actually in the bar scene. It was Arctic Berry Rum that got launched from Bacardi. They were the first, and then the food company that took Arctic and Nordic cuisine national actually was Joe's Crab Shack. They were the first ones to put it on their menu. They kind of came out with a whole series of Arctic bowls, and they went national. So every trend has its own parents and its own birth pattern and its own length of life cycle. They can cross over each other, but they are their own little entity.
Wow. I'm going to have to move my cell phone. Just thinking about alcohol, you could, Moscow Mules, they're everywhere now.
Oh, exactly.
Our conversation with Susie went a little bit longer than we expected, so we've gone ahead and broken this up into a two-part conversation. Check back for more.